The next case of the morning is number 02-1702, the United States against Cataldo and Serpico. Mr. Linden.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Good morning.
Matt Lydon, on behalf of the court, with respect to all issues raised and addressed in the defendant Serpico's brief on behalf of all the defendants. Your Honor, we've urged that there were several errors requiring either outright reversal or remand, but there is one overarching, subsuming issue in this appeal, which, if this court adopts the arguments of the defendants, will require reversal on all of the counts. And it's also an issue which we believe to be one of first impression within this circuit. And that's the issue of whether the language of Section 3293, subparagraph 2, which extends the usual five-year statute of limitations for mail fraud to 10 years, if the fraud that affects a financial institution, as countenance in that set out in that section, as the defense argues, is it required that the effect be one that produces an adverse impact or consequence on the financial institution? An actual or realistic probability of loss for the institution, and something less remote and speculative than what was offered in this case. In this case, we submit that the loan for deposit scheme, there were two schemes charged here, both being mail frauds, one involving a financial institution, the Capital Bank, the other a financial institution, the Mid-City Bank. And as the Capital Bank, it was this loans for deposit scheme. Was Section 3293 intended, and does it, in fact, reach a scheme to defraud some third party, not Capital Bank, when it produced a net benefit to a Capital Bank, just as Capital Bank contemplated? Capital Bank in no way lost anything by virtue of the alleged scheme, and indeed the government's evidence was that Capital Bank got exactly what it sought. With the hotel kickback scheme, as charged and contemplated, there was to be completed construction, and construction was completed. Again, Mid-City Bank got exactly what it bargained for with respect to a construction loan, which it was willing to lend money on. And if the permanent financing by the unions were to occur, that all happened. The bank got what it wanted. The bank was in no way harmed directly or indirectly. The bank was repaid every penny of interest and principal that it was entitled to. In both instances, both Capital Bank and Mid-City Bank perceived net benefits from these transactions, just as they bargained for those benefits, and they got them. And so our position is that with respect to that issue, there should be an outright reversal on all counts. These charges were not brought within the five-year statute of limitations. They were brought within the argued 10-year statute of limitations under 3293 subparagraph 2. I said that it's a case of first impression, and I don't believe there is any case that addresses the statute of limitations extender in this circuit. There are three other circuits, to our knowledge, who have addressed this issue. The second and third circuits addressed it in the Boyu case, which is in the briefs, and in the Palullo case. And in those instances, there was a fraud directly affecting the financial institution. In one instance, it was a subsidiary of the bank, but there was a direct and immediate impact and loss produced to the bank by the scheme. In some sense or another, it was recognized by the perpetrators of the fraud that the bank might be or was victimized.
Well, you say might be or was. You think might be isn't enough, right?
No, I'm not suggesting. Well, if it's foreseeable that the bank will indeed be harmed by your fraud.
No, not foreseeable that it will be, but could be.
Your Honor, I think
not to be.
I think that it can't be a speculative. Let me just state it that way. I don't think we can speculate about any conceivable loss that might occur to a bank and say that that brings the statute of limitations extender into place. I don't know if that answers the question, but that's what I mean by saying that it doesn't address any possible fraud that might be.
Well, I guess what I want to focus on is that but for some unusual behind-the-scenes transaction, whatever went on here, the bank wouldn't otherwise make that loan or expose itself to that risk.
Well, Your Honor, if we were taking the loans for deposit scheme, the bank indeed intended to do exactly what it did, and it perceived obviously a benefit from its perception, making loans in return for getting union deposits. That's something that it intended, and it was an objective that it sought, and it wasn't in any sense defrauded.
And that's probably true in a lot of legitimate transactions, I guess, right?
I'm sorry?
Legitimate transaction.
Yeah, someone would work the same way.
A large company puts its payroll deposits in and they get prime rate. That sort of thing.
Probably applies to a lot of law firms, too. I have no doubt that in that case. Your Honor, as I said, there were three circuits that have addressed it. There's only one that even comes close to what we have here, and that's in this Hackney case in the First Circuit. And I say that's the closest because in that instance, the First Circuit found no adequate effect on a financial institution in a wire fraud that occurred with respect to a third party being the victim. Even though part and parcel of the same transactions, it found bank fraud and it found a false statement to the same bank. That involved out of a letter of credit situation where a purchaser of a product set up a letter of credit. The purchaser of a product was in fact defrauded when the letter of credit was fraudulently drawn down upon with false documents. And the court had no trouble in finding that there had indeed been a bank fraud, that there had indeed been a false statement to the bank. But significantly, and of import to our argument here, it found no adequate effect on a financial institution with respect to the fraud that occurred on the party who had put up funds for the letter of credit. That is to say, they found no realistic probability of loss for the bank. And so the court upheld the bank fraud and 1014 convictions, but it reversed, saying that 3293 subparagraph 2 was not applicable because a bank had not been affected by fraud in that instance. And so I suggest that the Agni case is a case that the court can look to for some guidance, and I suggest that it supports the position that we're arguing here. The cases that have been addressed in the Seventh Circuit regarding effects of financial institutions have been cases under the sentencing guidelines. Even in those cases, I would suggest that in all instances, the court has looked for some probable loss to the financial institution or impact, realistic and probable impact on the financial institution in order to require that, in order to apply that enhancing section of the sentencing guidelines.
Why does it have to be a probable impact? Why can't it just be a possibility?
Well, doesn't it have to flow? It seems to me it has to flow from the fraud itself. And here I might add why I think that's the case. We also have to consider the fact that distinguishing this from a sentencing guideline case is the fact that this is a statute of limitations case where the Supreme Court has repeatedly said, and this court has said as well in the Anderson case, that a statute of limitations should be interpreted by the court in favor of repose. And so when you look to what it means to say affects a financial institution, you have to look at it in terms of favoring repose. And that being the case, it seems to me that the extender indeed has to be the exception to the rule of a five-year statute of limitations.
It seems like the purpose of this law is to really protect financial institutions. So it does that by extending the statute of limitations, doubling the statute of limitations. And if the purpose is to really protect the financial institution, why wouldn't just a possibility of just a little bit of an increased risk, anything like that, be enough to satisfy the statute?
Well, Your Honor, if we look to where the statute originated, it originated in, as you point out, concerns of Congress over protecting financial institutions. It was the savings and loan crisis that gave rise to this. And I think they're talking about instances where a bank or a financial institution is indeed targeted, that it is a foreseeable victim of the fraud. If the fraud goes as it will, the bank is probably, or the financial institution is probably going to suffer a loss. That, I believe, would be within the reach of the statute. But to just speculate about what might produce a loss to the bank, it seems to me, opens up and threatens to make the exception the rule. We can imagine all sorts of situations where a bank might be affected. For example, a depositor is duped of his deposits by some third party, withdrawing money from the bank. Is there an effect on a financial institution? Of course. Perhaps it's a large depositor, and so even greater deposits are withdrawn from the bank. But that's the transaction and the sort of thing that the bank itself understands when it enters into a deposit relationship. It can't be just any effect on a financial institution, and it can't be just any adverse effect. It seems to me that it has to be one that flows from, that is an impact of the fraud itself, that's a consequence of the fraud itself. In this instance, what was alleged to be the fraud was the fraud on the union entities. They were presumably they were to be the, and it was so charged, the victims of the fraud. It isn't alleged that, and wasn't certainly in any way proved, that the banks were defrauded.
What is this instruction that's referred to? I guess it's in the red brief here that refers to section 32.93.2. Which says that the government must prove that the scheme to defraud affected one or more federally insured financial institutions. In order to find that the scheme affected a financial institution, you must find that it exposed the financial institution to a new or increased risk of loss. And then it says a financial institution need not have actually suffered a loss in order to have been affected by the scheme.
I think that what that means, Your Honor, is that it was, even if they didn't actually suffer loss, but it was intended that they might, I think that would be within it.
Is that instruction correct, then?
Your Honor, I'm not defending that instruction.
Well, is it a waiver product of kind? If that instruction goes to the jury, is it a waiver of what maybe you're alleging now?
I don't know how we could have waived it if, in fact, it's an element.
I don't know. That's the instruction. If the instruction is incorrect, but it does say the financial institution need not have actually suffered a loss in order to have been affected by the scheme.
But nonetheless, that has to be a loss that flows from the scheme that was contemplated by the schemers, that wasn't something that the financial institution itself welcomed or bargained for, which is what we're talking about in this instance.
So
I don't think there was sufficient evidence.
So you're saying that's just a normal risk that the bank took on?
Absolutely.
Not something extraordinary or out of line?
Absolutely. The Mid-City construction loan, if the project wasn't completed, well, that's something that a bank always undertakes. That's a risk that's inherent in any construction loan.
And the bank was secured by the union guarantee or something?
And it had the union guarantee. It not only had the union takeout, the permanent financing commitment, but it also had the union's money on deposit at the bank to make the funding of the takeout that much easier. And with the loans for deposit again, there's a situation where the bank, the evidence is clear that the bank and the bankers internally intended to enter these transactions for the purpose of obtaining the benefits of the bargain, loans for deposits. That cannot be something that was intended to be covered by 3293. The bank isn't being victimized. I could go. There are other arguments that we've raised. As I said, that's the single overarching issue that it seems to me controls all the counts. But if we go further, there were other errors that occurred at this trial, specifically with respect to the hotel kickback scheme. It seems to the defense that the evidence there was wholly inadequate and speculative with respect to whether, in fact, any kickback occurred. What, in fact, we have is a situation where the bank was well aware of the, it wasn't misled. The draw requests that were submitted by Taylor West included one that was post-dated on its face. The bank knew the amount to be drawn was a contingency item, on the contingency item line. It was paid to Taylor West, paid to 51 Associates, just as 51 Associates representative would be, and 51 Associates in turn paid it to Taylor West exactly as it represented it would. There was no evidence, direct evidence of any kickback with respect to the hotel loan. Instead,
was that
the suggestion,
$333,000, or am I?
I'm sorry.
Was that the $333,000?
Yes, sir. Okay. Yes, Your Honor. The $333,000 that was generated could just as easily, as we suggested and argued, have gone to Mr. Cataldo's cousin. There's no evidence that it went to Mr. Serpico. And interestingly, and importantly, the court itself rejected that argument and held, again, in its written rulings, that the government had failed to present sufficient evidence to prove that any of the consulting fee, which Cataldo converted to cash, was kicked back to Serpico. And I'm quoting from what the court said in its sentencing memorandum. And that the jury was only allowed to determine whether the payments made by Cataldo in connection with the Cicero partnership constituted a kickback. What we're talking about there is Mr. Cataldo, in one partnership that he has with Mr. Serpico, writes a check which covers the expenses of both. What we also have in the evidence that the government introduced is the following year, or sometime after that, the reverse happens. Mr. Serpico pays everything on behalf of Mr. Cataldo. That's not evidence that suggests a kickback. That's the sort of evidence that's consistent with informal things that partners may be engaged in. But it is not any evidence of a kickback, and there was no direct evidence whatsoever to support such a conclusion. The error was compounded because, despite what the court said with respect to that cash, it sentenced Mr. Serpico and his co-defendant as though there was a $300,000 kickback. If we're going to talk about loss to the union, assuming that the fraud they alleged occurred, it could only be the amount that was actually proven to be a loss to the union. That would be the amount that Mr. Serpico supposedly got as a fee or kickback. The only evidence was $25,000. How that could get magnified to $300,000 was never explained.
Was there any connection made that the $25,000 was part of the 333?
Your Honor, I think it would be fact that Mr. Cataldo got money into his accounts. He wrote a check in payment of the expenses on behalf of Mr. Serpico, but no doubt part of this $333,000 consulting fee did go into the same accounts from which he wrote the checks. But there's, again, the court said it, and the only evidence of any sort of payment flowing from Cataldo to Serpico was this payment of expenses on behalf of Mr. Cepedo in a partnership in which both were involved. And it ignores, as I said, a couple of things. It ignores evidence that Mr. Cepedo had generated cash, according to the government, at that same time, approximately $30,000. It ignores other circumstantial evidence, such as the fact that in a subsequent year, Mr. Cepedo pays Mr. Cataldo's expenses. That's not evidence of a kickback. That's equally evidence that of an informal arrangement between partners in legitimate business ventures. And there was no evidence of a kickback.
Yes, Your Honor. Sorry, I believe your time has expired.
Sorry.
We'll hear now from Mr. Shulman.
Your Honor, I'd like to pick up on that last series of questions and answers about the cash. And that goes into the other argument that's particular to Cataldo instead of just joining in on Cepedo, which is the severance question. As Mr. Leiden said, as the record shows, at the close of the government's case, Judge Manning decided that there was no evidence that any of this cash went to either Cepedo or the other co-defendant. So she threw those counts out. She also threw out some other counts against the co-defendants in which Mr. Cataldo was not named. However, Mr. Cataldo faced the trial with all that evidence. The evidence that he was never charged with, that was not only not just admitted, but at the end of the day, it was found not to prove anything. All the evidence against Mr. Cataldo about this cashing of the money, and at the end of the day, that was found not to prove anything. Now, coming back, and it goes throughout the government's brief, is this question that, well, we could still prove the $25,000 that was paid in for the expenses in the Cicero property, but that was not paid in cash. That was paid in a check. The exhibit that supports that is in the appendix. I think it's 836 under tab 6. It was a government exhibit. Every dime that was paid by Mr. Cataldo for Mr. Cepedo's expenses in the Cicero property was check. Had nothing to do with cash. Government lost on the argument that cash couldn't go anywhere and now is trying to revive it in their brief. In three or four places they say that that they could still use this proof of cash to support the Cicero payments, but it was never in cash. The other thing about these kickbacks on the Cicero property is, I think it's at pages 29 to 30, when the government argues on the sufficiency of the evidence in their brief. They have a whole series of the jury could reasonably believe this, the jury could reasonably believe this, the jury could reasonably believe this. The one thing that they don't have any evidence of is any agreement between Mr. Cataldo and Mr. Cepedo prior to the loan or prior to the first check that was paid to Mr. Cataldo. And then to tie those up to a later on payment by Mr. Cataldo of some expenses at 3 or 4 months after and then a year after is what the government's arguing between the Cicero and the Taylor Street property, that there's no way of knowing in 90 what you're going to need in 91. Well, I submit if that argument's good enough for them, it's good enough for us, because without any evidence of Cataldo and Cepedo agreeing anything before the first check, which was in April of 1990, then whatever happens afterwards is not evidence that they had a prior agreement or a prior scheme going on. Just the last thing I'd like to mention, unless the panel has any questions, is the government never did respond to my quote from the Schneider case about the issue of loss. I mean, Judge Manning found three or four different places there was no loss. And the Schneider case says when there's no loss, you don't get the bonus points. But we got the bonus points tacked on to us. That case prohibits that activity. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Shulman. We'll hear now from Mr. Glockner.
Good Morning. May it please the court, counsel. The object of both of the schemes of which the defendants were convicted, the loans for deposit scheme and the scheme to obtain financing for the construction of the Trade Center South Hotel in Champaign through a kickback, was to have banks make loans that they would not otherwise make. And in the course of those schemes, to place very large deposits into banks that those banks would not otherwise have received. Taking deposits and making loans those are the core functions of a financial institution. Making a loan, especially the large sorts of loans involved in this case, by definition exposes a financial institution to risk. To put it, I guess, a slightly different way, the purpose of the scheme, the object of the scheme, was to get banks to expose themselves to risks of loss. Mr. Leiden talked about the three appellate decisions, all from other circuits, that have begun to explore the contours of Section 3293. And I think Mr. Leiden is right that at the outer limits of Section 3293, there's some fairly interesting issues. Does an effect have to be a negative effect? The statute doesn't say so. What is sufficient for an effect? The case law hasn't explored the outer limits. But the important thing with respect to this case is we are well within any, the government's proof in this case is well within any of the standards applied by any of the courts that have interpreted either Section 3293 or the parallel language in the sentencing guidelines. Palullo and Boya, the cases from the Second and Third Circuits, both deal with situations where the financial institution was defrauded, where it was victimized by the fraud. The court in Palullo, which was the first of these two cases to be decided, made it clear in its analysis of the statute that what Congress was attempting to do in enacting Section 3293, which was part of FIREA, enacted at a time when Congress was very concerned with protecting financial institutions from exposure to risk in the tough context of fraudulent schemes, that Section 3293 meant to provide a broader coverage to financial institutions and reach more broadly than simply the class of financial institutions that were directly affected. So in essence, what the court was saying in those cases was that a financial institution doesn't have to be the victim of a fraud in order to be covered by the statute of limitations extender in that provision.
Well, what does it do? Does it have to, is it facilitating it? Does it, and not the victim? For instance, if a bank is going to make a loan it wouldn't otherwise make, but it's going to insist on substantial deposits, perhaps even those that it can secure, is it then facilitating wherever those deposits come from, facilitating whoever gets the deposits from another victim? Is it helping that? I guess it is taking money it wouldn't otherwise get, and then sort of whitewashing whatever the expenditure was. Is the bank participating in the scheme, I guess?
Well, in the...
Therefore not a victim.
Clearly in the case of the loan for deposit scheme here, Capital Bank was a participant in the scheme. And I think, in fact, that's precisely the sort of conduct that Congress would be concerned to protect. Congress didn't want at the time that FIREA was passed, financial institutions to be exposed to risks as a result of fraud schemes. Here you had a financial institution scheming with outsiders to engage in conduct that exposed the financial institution to significant risk. If you look at the testimony relating to the loans that were made by Capital Bank as part of the loans for deposit scheme, and I'll mention just as an aside, this was not, as Mr. Lydon suggested, a scheme that involved just Capital Bank. This was a 12-year scheme that involved a total of, I believe, 8 different banks and roughly 15 or 16 loans at different institutions. Capital was the one where the conduct was best documented because it was the last in the sequence and it was where the behavior got most out of hand. But the testimony from the president of Capital Bank during the time when many of these loans occurred was really kind of a parade of horribles with respect to the nature of the risks involved in these loans. Among other things, Capital Bank made a $1 million unsecured loan to Mr. Serpico, Mr. Cataldo, and a third person with respect to a commercial building on Taylor Street in Chicago for which there were no tenants and no end takeout. They made a $1.8 million loan to a failing film studio that the bank president testified didn't have the cash flow to support the loan.
Is that the one that they made the big profit on?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
That's perplexing.
Well,
I mean, I understand I have a hard time understanding the whole thing, frankly. Maybe that's what it's supposed to do. But the $25,000 that went to Serpico, right? And then he invested in the film company and made a profit of $475,000. Is that right?
Close, Your Honor. What the evidence at trial showed was that Mr. Serpico invested $25,000 to acquire his interest in Studio Network, this film studio operation. He acquired that interest in, I believe it was 1983. The acquisition of the film studio was financed by Exchange National Bank as part of the scheme. Exchange National Bank received union deposits the day after Mr. Serpico and his partner in that venture, Morgan Murphy, visited Exchange to solicit a loan. The project was at various points in foreclosure and in other financial straits through the time in, I believe it was 1987, when they moved the loan to Capital Bank. Capital Bank kept the project afloat. It at that point was not making timely payments on its loan to its then principal lender, Midwest Bank, another bank that was a large recipient of union funds. And Mr. Serpico ultimately sold his interest in Studio Network for $500,000 in the spring of 1988.
An interest he had paid $25,000 for?
Right. Effectively,
well, this thing's falling apart. Who the heck would pay that much for it?
It was essentially a real estate speculation venture. The film studio, the core business, was failing. And the testimony from the bankers and the notes in the bank file were very clear that this is a very risky, very speculative project from the bank's perspective in terms of whether they would be paid. In essence, Mr. Serpico and the bank got very, very lucky that somebody was willing to come and pay a very large amount for the hotel.
For the real estate.
For the real estate. Right, I'm confusing my schemes here. One other point, just going back briefly to the issue concerning the statute of limitations. all of the case law that has developed in this area is consistent with or affirmatively endorses the proposition that exposure of a bank to a risk of loss is sufficient to affect a financial institution. Even Agnew, the case that Mr. Lydon relies on, says that. There also are a number of cases, principally in the context of the sentencing guideline enhancement, that provides an enhancement for certain offenses that affect a financial institution, that make it clear that you can affect a financial institution in ways that are non-financial. Johnson, for example, the Ninth Circuit case that's cited in our brief, talks about a scheme where there was an effect on employee morale, there was disruption to the bank's activities. There are a whole range of ways in which a bank can be adversely affected. With respect to the manner in which Mid-City Bank was affected by the scheme, here the object of the hotel loan kickback scheme was to obtain financing for a speculative hotel construction venture that the developers were having trouble funding. You can't obtain funding for the construction of a hotel until you have end financing in place. You can't pre-lease a hotel, you can't pre-sell it. The testimony from the lender at Mid-City and the testimony from the developers was that in order to obtain the financing to build the hotel, there had to be the permanent mortgage in place.
But that's usually from somewhere else. You have a construction loan, you have takeout, and that takeout is usually from some other source.
It often is. I don't know that the evidence indicated one way or another whether it was usual or not, but it is it's a common arrangement. What the evidence showed with respect to the hotel loan kickback scheme was that the object of the scheme was to obtain financing from the union, the permanent financing. As soon as they had that commitment from the union, they were then able to obtain Mid-City's construction loan, the $6.5 million construction loan, which was then matched with a $6.5 million permanent mortgage. In fact, both of these loans opened simultaneously. There's a four-party agreement between Mid-City, the pension fund, the union entities, and then a bank that actually held title to the real estate relating to the interlocking nature of the financing.
Well, was the bank's participation in that one on the $333,000 where they loaned an excessive amount so that consulting fees could be paid? And that was money that should have otherwise gone to the union of interest. I have a hard time figuring all this out. Is that a fair summary, or is it not?
It's close, Your Honor. There were two ways in which Mid-City was affected by this scheme. First, absent the kickback, they would not have made this loan. The kickback that obtained the pension fund mortgage, and the clear testimony from the Mid-City banker was, no pension fund mortgage, we can't go near this because there's no end takeout. And Mid-City bore the risk that construction wouldn't be completed within the time period set in the loan agreement. Mr. Lydon described this as essentially a riskless transaction for Mid-City, and the testimony at trial was that was far from the case, because if the hotel was not completed with the available funds and within the specified time period, then the pension funds and takeout obligation was extinguished.
But isn't this the risk a bank would usually incur in a situation like this?
Yes and no. A bank takes a risk any time it makes a loan. But this was a risk that the bank was exposed to because of this kickback scheme. And moreover, Mid-City, in addition to being exposed to the risk of the loan that it would not otherwise have been exposed to by the scheme, Mid-City was affected because a portion of the loan proceeds were diverted to pay the kickback.
Well, that, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, maybe the other same question. What, how did Mid-City benefit from that?
Well, our argument is Mid-City absolutely did not benefit.
So,
Mid-City was exposed to a risk of loss, and Mid-City was actually victimized by the fraud scheme.
Why would they do it then?
Mid-City made the construction loan because it believed, with the information presented to it, that the loan was a business risk that it was prepared to take.
Why?
Nobody told.
Why would they take that risk? Is there something coming, bigger deposits? Is somebody at the bank going to get money?
Part of the reason that Mid-City was happy to take this risk was because the way the loan was structured, the $6.5 million end mortgage was opened simultaneously with the Mid-City construction loan. The end mortgage proceeds, since they weren't needed immediately because they're just sitting around until construction is completed, were deposited in certificates of deposit at Mid-City Bank pending completion of construction. Once construction was completed, assuming that the conditions for the end takeout were met, then that money would be used to repay Mid-City. But
the bank gambled that this was going to get done on time because the union could, under that contract, jerk their funds.
Absolutely.
And not have to pay off the loan.
Absolutely. And one of the reasons that this was an attractive proposition for Mid-City was that the loan was, in essence, self-funding. If a bank is going to make a $6.5 million loan, in ordinary circumstances, one of the things that the bank has to figure out is where do we get the $6.5 million that we're going to lend. Here, because of the arrangement with the pension fund, an arrangement that was secured through the kickback scheme, Mid-City had the $6.5 million from the union at the time the construction loan was opened. So Mid-City didn't have to worry about where it was going to get the money.
So where is the bank adversely affected?
The bank is adversely affected in two regards. First, the bank is exposed to the very substantial risk that construction would not be completed on time and within the available funds.
That could, every time they do a construction loan, they incur that risk.
That's right.
That's just a risk of doing business.
It's a risk of doing business, but it's a risk that was imposed on the bank in this circumstance because the bank, because the kickback scheme put the bank into this loan transaction. What I think Section 3293 does is it's saying to participants in fraudulent schemes, whatever you do, don't put our banks at risk. The scheme, the object of this scheme was to put Mid-City at risk.
Now, on the kickback, it was the draw on the loan, am I correct? Isn't that the way it actually occurred?
The kickback was funded in part by a draw from the loan. The total kickback amount was $333,850. Mm-hmm. The first portion of the kickback, $133,850, mm-hmm. was financed by a draw on the construction loan in Mid-City. That draw was booked by the developers and represented to Mid-City as an architectural and engineering expense. That was simply a fraud. Mid-City was deceived into allowing the expenditure of construction funds, which the bank president testified were funds that are very carefully allocated according to a set budget and schedule to protect the bank's interest in ensuring that construction is done on time and within budget. Those funds were diverted to pay a kickback. And the problem with that is that the diversion of funds for work that's not completed, for work that's unnecessary, and in particular for work or an arrangement that's criminal, is that those funds aren't available for the furtherance of the actual construction. And particularly when you have funds diverted for a criminal purpose, you have the added uncertainties associated with potential criminal liability.
Yeah, if the kickback scheme was the motivating factor for the loan, and then if the kickback scheme is exposed, that's a serious risk, isn't it?
All hell breaks loose. I mean, I don't know how you would sort out what the liabilities are of the various parties, but at a minimum, Mid-City has to worry that if the pension fund discovers that its end takeout obligation was procured by a kickback, there is a significant degree of uncertainty as to the pension fund's willingness to continue with that commitment.
The whole project could be delayed, could it?
Absolutely. It injects a substantial degree of uncertainty into the continuation and the financing of the project. And it's precisely that injection of risk which is sufficient under Agnew, under Boya, under Palullo to affect a financial institution.
I hate to belabor this, but you said $133,000. The other $200,000, I don't know where that came from, but I assume that was in part of the construction loan as well at some point.
That's actually not correct, Your Honor. The other $200,000 was funded by the developers themselves. The trouble with that, though, is that there's a certain amount of money that you expect the developers to put into the project, and to the extent that they are siphoning off money that they're supposed to be contributing to the project, even if it's not actual loan proof, there's less available.
Would you label, what didn't the union get that these guys got? Is it $133,000?
No. Our argument is that because Cataldo and Serpico were joint venturers, co-schemers in the kickback scheme, under Section 501C, Title 29, which makes it clear that any benefit or profit that a union fiduciary receives by virtue of any action that he takes on behalf of the labor organization, that money belongs to the union. What Mr. Serpico and Mr. Cataldo did was leverage or engineer a $333,000 kickback paid to Mr. Cataldo. They then made whatever arrangements they chose to between themselves in terms of the split. The evidence at trial showed that $25,000 roughly was paid by Mr. Cataldo to Mr. Serpico in connection with the partnership for the construction of the townhouses in Cicero. And by the way, I think you asked during the earlier argument whether that money was traced to the kickback fund. And my recollection is that the testimony at trial established a direct trace, that came directly out of the kickback proceeds. I'd like to talk just very briefly about the government's affirmative appeal in this case. The district court applied Section 2F 1.1, and the as we've argued in our brief, the more appropriate guidelines were Section 2E 5.1. Through application of the cross-reference provision.
This seems like an odd argument, because you want the fraud statute to extend the statute of limitations by double statute of limitations, but then when it comes to sentencing, you don't want to use that statute because it has a weaker sentencing provision. That's like
bait and switch or something?
Yeah.
I disagree with that. And that's because we're simply applying the fraud guideline What you do in the first place is you look to the guideline referenced by the statutory index. That's 2F1.1. But when you look to 2F1.1, there's a clear cross-reference that takes you to another guideline. You can't ignore the cross-reference, which is part of 2F1.1, simply because that's where you start. And the statute of limitations and the guidelines issues, I think, really are two completely different concepts.
Thank you, Mr. Klockner. There's no rebuttal time, but sir, we'll give you 90 seconds if you've got something you'd like to emphasize.
I just want to address the Mid-City loan. Aside from this being totally speculative as to what might happen if, in fact, someone learned about a bribe having been paid in order to obtain the commitment, that ignores the commercial reality of the transaction, which is that as a third-party beneficiary to the commitment, it seems to me that Mid-City Bank would be altogether entitled to enforce its takeout commitment. Supposedly, the object of the scheme was to get a mortgage commitment. They got the mortgage commitment, and therefore, it seems to me that we're speculating about any risk that could occur.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, our thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.